Welcome to the Cannabis Connection. I am your host, Christopher Carr. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Santa Cruz Cannabis Talk Radio here, SantaCruzVoice.com, 831-265-5050. We are welcoming back Malcolm McKinnon, widely known as Dan Sky, has etched his name in cannabis history as the former editor-in-chief of High Times magazine. Over 25 trailblazing years, Malcolm traveled, interviewed, and photographed, crafting an unrivaled archive of cannabis photography. He's recognized globally for his dedication. Malcolm's passion has always been the camera, capturing cannabis culture's essence from its advocates to its adversaries. We're celebrating the release of his new book, Pot Shots, The Journey of a High Times Photographer. It isn't just a visual spectacle, it's a poignant reminder of the movement's journey. Malcolm's voice and vision are unparalleled, making this book an indispensable gem for every cannabis and art enthusiast. Welcome back, Malcolm.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I couldn't agree more with that introduction. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. It was well written. It's beautiful. So congrats on the release.
I might have had a hand in writing that.
That's right. Yeah. It's really nice.
Thank you
nicely
just the same.
Well, thank you for coming back. And how are you? Tell the people where you're joining us this evening.
I'm in New York City. Just released my book this past Wednesday. Pot Shots, Journey of a High Times Photographer, covers my career in photography and all of the wonderful things I've done. It features over 300 photos and 200 pages of pot photography. It's kind of a historical document when you get down to it, but it also is a lot of fun to read. There are models in there, lots of celebrities, gardens, buds, glass bongs, all kinds of different things that you'd expect from a cannabis retrospective like this. So I'm really happy about it. It's getting some good vibes.
Steve Bloom. Yeah, I saw that. Oh, wonderful. Steve. It's very cool to see Celeb Stoner. We had him on since you and I last spoke. Steve came on the show. I actually followed up from you speaking to your working with him and love to hear a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, sure. No, Steve was he was one of the top editors at High Times magazine. He truly was. He brought in a lot of celebrities during the 90s and the early 2000s. He had great music connections. And the thing about Steve, he's one of the few High Times people who really, really continued their activism. I think he's probably the most stalwart activist of all the High Times people. He's been at it since the 80s. I mean, he's one of the originals, and he's still at it. You know, he's in charge of the New York Marijuana March, which happens every first Saturday in May. And he invites all of the performers on stage, and he does a wonderful job. So he's well known. He gets around. He's a member of Normal. Has been on the board, I think, for a while. And Steve's great.
Well, it's a great book. It's a perfect time of year. My family will definitely get a copy. I'm going to get some copies here. And wanted to hear a little bit about your process and curating. It's after so many important decades and years and milestones, like 2 months in cannabis is like a year in any other space. And you've been working, so diligently in these really, like you said, a historical document. I would love to hear your process in curating what to choose. I imagine it was a tricky, process of curating a new book.
It sure was. I shot my first, cannabis-related photos for High Times in 1989. Peter Gorman, who died last year, was a good friend of mine. And he had come back from India with Rocket Munaka, which is a bang candy. Bang, of course, is cannabis in India. And he came back with this, and that was wrote a feature on this, and I photographed the bang candy. And so my association with Peter went on from there. He recommended me for some of his features, and I became a staff photographer and I became a photo editor in 1992 for High Times. And the thing is, I was trained in journalism. I had a double major in college in mass communications and journalism. So I was able to fit in real well with High Times. I was a good writer. and that's how it started. But, you know, when I first started out, I really wasn't a cannabis activist of any sort. You know, I really was more interested in getting my photos published. And, you know, I evolved as a cannabis activist, I think. I always smoked pot, but I didn't really think that much about what it was required in order to get it legal. But, you know, high times changed everything. That I never expected to have a 25-year career at high times, but, you know, it worked out well, and it turns out to be like over a third of my life spent with high times, you know. But curating the book, wow, that was really a trick. I mean, I think the first photos that I really, really realized that I was, you know, on my way and doing something is when I shot Jack Harer, who, of course, as your audience probably knows,
yes,
you know, he's the godfather of cannabis. You know, he wore the Emperor's Wears No Clothes. And he was the leader of the cannabis legalization movement for years and years and years.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Yes. So I was, you know, I photographed Jack in 1995 for his first cover of High Times. I ended up shooting all three of the covers he was on, that he graced for us. But, you know, I spent a few days with him in Los Angeles and shot him in a number of locations. And all these photos are in the book. And I realized, you know, when the response to these photos was just, you know, tremendous, you know, because everybody loved Jack, and this was the first time they'd really seen him in these kind of portraits. So I realized, you know, that I was onto something, that, you know, cannabis photography had its, you know, there was nobody really filling that void. And here I was in this wonderful, wonderful position to, you know, shoot the movement as the legalization laid its foundation, you know, all the way to legalization, you know. And I met all the great icons of cannabis, from Dennis Perone and, you know, Tommy Chong. I shot three of his covers. You know, I ended up shooting over 40 covers for High Times magazine. So, you know, it was, you know, as I say, I never expected to do this, you know, but I ended up, you know, writing this book. People were asking for it. And I said, well, damn it, I got to put it together. So I finally did.
Good for you.
Yes. And I want to, you know, everybody should check it out. I mean, because it's you go to potshotsbook.com, and you can check it out. Woody Harrelson, Tommy Chong, Jorge Cervantes have all endorsed it. You know, I think it's wonderful. And, you know, I think for anybody who wants to know about cannabis history and our cannabis culture, I think this is a book that I think will be very important to them.
Agreed. Yeah, no, I'm very excited to dive in. And I think it's interesting because we've come a long way and so much has changed, and truly it was a powerful movement. There was so much potential, and way things have kind of unraveled. There's a mixed bag, especially in California. And I imagine in New York City, there's a bit of a like Wild West moment happening. Maybe you could shed light on that. We may have spoken a little bit about it, but I still hear some interesting. Even Steve spoke to this a bit, and how out of control it is a little bit.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it started off, there were some very, very strict regulations, and everybody seemed to be handling it well. And then when, you know, legalization, recreational, we really became legal, it just, everything came out of the woodwork. And there's so-called illegal pot shops all over New York City, all over the place. I think in some of the suburbs, it's not quite as bad. The police are a little bit more vigilant. But, you know, New York is a city of 8 million people. And, you know, there are pot shops and head shops, and people are selling, you know, over-the-counter. And the black market is still alive and well. I think one of the biggest reasons, and I don't want to see people get busted for it again, but by any means. But the thing is, if we're going to regulate it, you know, or we're going to have it legalized, you have to have politicians and people running it who understand what marijuana is, how hard it is to produce, and all of the hurdles that dispensaries have to go through in order to, you know, to service their customers. I mean, it's a difficult profession. It's not a gold mine like all these politicians and other people try to portray it, like Fox News and the New York Post, for example. They're always trashing marijuana in the city. Oh, the city smells like pot everywhere. No, it doesn't. You know, and you're complaining about the smell of pot in New York City? Really? That's the smell you're concerned about. You know, seriously. So,
yeah,
you know, the people don't understand marijuana, and they, you know, certainly they put a lot of hardships on the people who are trying to produce it. I mean, you know, for example, in Colorado, when it first started in 2014, there was like these people were being taxed to death. I mean, good Lord, 27% tax on a new industry. why don't you help the industry along a little bit?
Yeah.
Good Lord, you're going to still make the same amount of money if you let it flourish.
That's right. Yeah. No, there's a lot of lessons learned in retrospect. And in recent news in Santa Cruz, and I imagine this is happening all over the country, it's just to this community, the amount of robberies, theft.
And oh, boy.
It's been really unfortunate to the point where the situation here in Santa Cruz, there was a robbery happening in the kind of industrial part of town. The operator showed up and caught the robbers as they were fleeing, and essentially used his vehicle to ram. There was two cars, getaway cars, and the police. Well, and I think there was a shots exchanged, shots fired. But he was the first to the scene. The police never made it until after they had fled. They arrested him for defending his property. And he just got out, but he was being held in jail and they stopped investigating the thieves. They found an abandoned van and that was it. So it was backwards. You know, it's just so sad, the dissonance.
Yeah, it really is upside down. You know, it truly is. And the fact is, I remember when it first, legalization first came to California, the dispensaries that were open, they had armed guards. I remember in Los Angeles, I remember writing a story about it. I remember a lot of people were very upset about that. The fact that I wrote about the fact that there were armed guards, you know, they actually followed you around inside the store. I mean, seriously. I mean, that is the reality, that a lot of these dispensaries had armed guards.
Yeah.
Now, but this is, it's like there's a lot of, smash and grab.
That's
jewelry
right.
store robberies coming down. And there are also these wolf packs of people coming into stores. It's a dangerous time we're living in. And I think a lot of people are very, very upset about this. This is not, I don't care how liberal you are, but there's got to be a stop to this. This is just not right. This is not the way America is supposed to work.
100%.
So,
No, it's still to this day, we've come a long way, but there's still like a bit of a pre-prohibition stigma from law enforcement. It's just a little, the dissonance is unsettling, and it's not,
yeah,
it's not unique to one. It's happening all over.
But the thing is, some other store. Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, some other store, some other business who takes the law into their own hands. I don't think they're going to be treated the same way
a marijuana store. Well said.
I think that's the dissonance. I think that you're talking about.
Yeah,
the fact that this is allowed to happen, and if this happened in a jewelry store, somebody did a smash and grab, and the owner whipped out a gun and started shooting. I hope this never happens. I know it does. It's a terrible thing. I mean, we're getting way off the subject here. We're going to get into gun control and everything else.
There's a couple other interesting subjects I do want to shed light on. Yeah. I'm curious about the book. I know the book is very focused on the tenure with High Times, but I would be amiss if I didn't ask you about your time with the indigenous peoples of North America, Native American leaders. John Trudell, and there's another piece to your story that I wanted to shed light on. It came up a little bit with Steve. My family, we have roots in New Mexico, Yucaria, New Mexico, Apache Nation. And, it's very interesting. There was a moment there and a movement there that you were a part of too. And maybe we could explore that.
Sure. Well, some of my first stories with High Times with Peter Gorman, once again, we were covering the Native American Church, which is the Native American Church where they do ingest peyote in an all-night ceremony. And it's a very prayerful ceremony. It's nothing about, it's not related to the idea of tripping or anything like that. It's very prayerful, very much a church, and it's an all-night ceremony in a teepee. So I was covering that with Peter Gorman. We also covered the legacy of Quanah Parker, who brought peyote to the Native American church. He was a great Comanche chief who died in the early 1900s and who, was one of the outstanding Comanche chiefs who really did not surrender until the very, very end, and went on to become very, very successful cattlemen on top of that.
Wow.
But regardless of that, I started doing Native American stories in the early 90s. And, some of my first stories that I published with High Times were about Native American stories. Were Native American stories. For example, I covered the Hopi Prophecy. I covered, once again, Quanah Parker. I did a few different things. And so I was kind of more interested in Native American issues at that time. But I realized, you know, that if I was going to have my get my photos published, I'm going to have to write as well. I mean, I'm not really, crazy about writing when you get down to it. I think I'm a good writer, but, I don't think I have that writer sensibility where you were, I have to write. I must write every day. But anyway, getting off the track there. But I started, the more I got into Native American issues, the more Native American people I met. And luckily for me, it came along when I was doing Hemp Times, when I was executive editor of that magazine, that the Navajo were extremely interested in starting to grow hemp. So a group of activists got together and brought 100 pounds of seeds onto the Navajo reservation in 1996. And this was, huge news. Unfortunately, when they grew the seeds, it was a terrible drought year on the reservation and nothing grew.
Oh, how sad. Yeah.
So it didn't. So, but the thing is, once the Navajo grew, other tribes started to pick it up, and the Lakotas looked into it and started the Lakota Hemp Project in 1997, and they actually grew crops in 2000, 2001, and 2002. All of those crops were raided by the FBI, the DEA, and tribal police, and so I was covered all of those issues as well, all those attempts to grow hemp, and So all of these, through these associations with hemp and Native American issues, I got to meet a lot more people, from John Trudell, who I interviewed, and Clyde Bellacourt, Winona LaDuc, and I visited, you got to know Leonard Peltier quite well, and he has taken a number of my Native American images and portraits and has turned them into paintings. He's become a very, very fine painter behind bars. People don't know who Leonard Peltier is. I mean, it's really one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in American history. People can read about it. They can also watch the movie Incident at Oglala. It's free on YouTube. You can check that out. See who Leonard Peltier is. He has been in jail since 1977 for the murder of two FBI agents, and he is absolutely innocent, and he has not been pardoned, and he should be pardoned. And if you find out about Leonard Peltier, you're going to be aghast at what the federal government did to him, railroading him for the murder of these two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation back in 1975. Now, people should read about this. It's not a well-known case. It is extremely well-known, and a lot of world leaders have come to his defense and demanded that he be pardoned. But a lot of people, I think, there's so much happening in the news, they forget about this one man who's probably the most famous Native American of all right now because he's in prison. But people, once again, Leonard Peltier, people should read about him. You can go to whoisleonardpeltier.info, find out who this man is. He's a great painter behind bars, and he's become a real leader for peace. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize like 4 or 5 times
for
his work behind bars.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've covered Native American issues for a long time. Been involved in a lot of, met a lot of great leaders, and I love taking photos of Native American life, and that's on my website. People can go to malcolmmckinnon.com or nativeamericanphotography.com, and you can check out what I've done, and it also will tell you a little bit about Leonard Peltier as well. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I love to talk about Native American issues. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating because there was a move. You mentioned Jack Hare and Dennis Perone and Brownie Mary, Val Corral, all these wonderful people in the cannabis and the medical movement of cannabis. But, of course, there's these other people doing very important work. Yeah, Leonard, we sing about him. There's a song our band plays called Revolutionist, and it's a fascinating, unfortunate reality still to this day that our justice system is there's dissonance there as well.
The fact is, I think to be honest, the FBI is the agency that's been standing in the way of this. They are very, very against him being released. Now, they were certainly instrumental in having him railroaded. A lot of ballistic evidence was faked. There were witnesses who were coerced. and a lot of evidence was not allowed into the court. So it's a pretty bad situation. The fact is, Clinton could have pardoned him, and he promised a lot of people that he would. Everybody expected Obama might. I'm only talking about the Democratic presidents, but he didn't. We never expected Trump to pardon Peltier. So it's up to Biden, and Biden has been thoroughly informed and thoroughly versed in Leonard Peltier's case. He's not ignorant of this. He knows that people are demanding his release. But right now, I guess there are other fish to fry. So, you know, Leonard is, you know, a forgotten man. He's, you know, 79 years old. He's in very, very poor health. And he's been in prison for 47 years. Jeez. But other people who have, you know, committed real crimes have been released and pardoned, you know?
Yeah.
People who have done, you know, life sentences have been released years ago. So it's a real travesty of justice here in the United States. Just as marijuana has been, you know?
Yes.
Seriously. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you can, you know, I don't know if you talk to your listeners about what happened, you know, in Ohio. They're already trying to, you know, like pull, you know, roll back the will of the voters. The voters voted, you know, to make it recreational.
And yes.
The Republican lawmakers are already trying to look for ways to, like, then no, you didn't understand what you were voting for.
What? You know, I have not. No, could you inform us? I broke the news, and we spoke about it too when of course election day was November 7th, so it's fairly recent news. So within
the thing is, they're going after. they're certainly trying to, you know, figure out a way to get around the abortion issue, the Republicans, and they're also, you know, the Republicans, the GOP is anti-pot, and it seems to be an issue they're rallying around. It seems like anything that people really enjoy, they're against. You know, and there's a lot of it is driven by religion.
Sure.
I mean, they have a very these Christian fascists that we're now being surrounded by.
Yeah.
They want everything scary. to be run the way they want, you know, they envision the way God would want us to run things. So
sure.
This is why it's happening. So marijuana is one of those issues. You know, you have Laura Ingraham talking terrible things about marijuana.
Yeah.
You know, this woman wears a crucifix around her neck.
That's right. Well, if you read the Bible, I mean, King Solomon, there's traces of cannabis use for thousands of years and for generations. And of course, of the times of the gospel and the Jesus and even the Old Testament, you know, cannabis has been a part of the story of if you're a true religious scholar, you would know this.
Well, I think your listeners would be very interested in an interview with Chris Bennett, who is a great cannabis researcher on the nature of religion. He's from British Columbia, and he has written a number of books on cannabis and religion. He's one of the true experts, and you should definitely have him on the show because he will He will break it down. I'll get you in touch with Chris.
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating subject, just on my own personal reading and it comes up in conversations too. I've been doing this show every Friday since 2015, and it's something to think about. And for many people, cannabis, I mean, think of Rastafari. Think of, it's a very spiritual sacrament for a lot of people. And I love what you said about the Native American church too. Our band was privileged to do the Sweat Lodge and to sit in a couple ceremonies and near Santa Cruz in Gilroy. And we have some elders and a roadman that provides that ceremony for some of our community. It's a life-changing spiritual practice, a way of life.
Right.
It's not about tripping or having a trip. It's actually filled with prayer, filled with reflection and with the goal of getting well. That's kind of something that's correlated to cannabis, too. For some people, it helps them with their wellness, spiritually and physically.
Unfortunately, in this country, you know, I remember I interviewed Russell Means back in, I believe, 2008, and I had a nice interview to sit down with him. And, you know, I asked him a very basic question. I said, what do you believe, you know, Americans' image is of Native Americans? He goes, image? He said, we're invisible. You know, that's the image. People don't even recognize that we're here. They have their own lives. They don't think about Native Americans. It's not like, you know, you can't compare African Americans or anything like that. You know, it's He said, we're the forgotten people. You know, you hear about Native Americans now and then. You hear now because you have a lot more media entertainment outlets for Native Americans, which is great. But still, it's not something that's really thought about, you know, in terms of racism.
That's right, or appropriation,
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, people don't have that understanding of what they go through. And the fact is there are a lot of, they live in a lot of very mineral-rich country where uranium, you know, there's a lot of these corporations would like to get their hands on that, so they want to move in and destroy their water supply by doing so. So they have a lot of issues that they have to fight, and they don't get a lot of support from the communities, you know, that are going to benefit from, you know, the uranium interests and so forth. So it's, yeah, it's people just don't understand the issues, you know, that they go through. And it's also, you know, for example, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, there, you know, this is a huge reservation. It truly, you know, it's 5,000 square miles, I believe. There's no bus system. There's no train. There's no, you know, there's no industry of any kind. It's a very, very difficult place to live. You know, gas, the price of gas getting across the reservation costs a lot of money. So, you know, people don't understand just the basics, you know, the things that we take for granted, living in cities and living with so much convenience, they don't have. Wow. I mean, I remember doing a lecture a few years back, and somebody asked me, they still live in teepees? You're like, oh, my God, you know, Jesus. So, you know, there's still, I think, a real lack of understanding on the part of most Americans. I know a lot of people, we could all do a lot of
we could all do better, right? Well,
we could all do better.
Yeah, we could all do better. And the women disappearing and the kidnapping and that's another really dark, sad. Like you said, the invisible people, the forgotten people. Yet this is the source of all
the white people. I mean, look what Gabby Petito last year. You know, she disappears. Her boyfriend kills her. You know, it's on the national news every damn day.
That's right.
You know, this is happening. You know, but it's happening on the reservations. You know, far, far too much. I mean, it's an epidemic. So, you know,
it's important. It's important to shed light on these and to. I mean, that is the month we're in, but every month is, that's their life, and it's our roots. There's a lot of people, too, that are, over time, it's interesting, there is a new generation. There's a friend of mine, Juan, that does a podcast called Burn the Wagon, and he's, you know, there are people and a new generation that is hoping to elevate and shine light on their roots and their community. It's really, it brings me to this other segue that I was curious about when you spoke about how you were trained in journalism and, you know, the state of the world. You mentioned the Hopi prophecy. You know, there's a lot of scary things in the Middle East, in Europe, Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia. There's this scary moment we're living in. We mentioned Biden, and luckily there was a pleasant exchange, I think, or at least an amicable exchange between two superpowers in San Francisco here in California this week. Right. So pretty crazy time we're living in. And your thoughts on journalism and like maybe advice to like this next generation, like Juan or these next generation of people that are trying to shed light on things and hopefully keep a level head.
Well, you know, one thing I always object to people calling, you know, the mainstream media as if the mainstream media is completely corrupt. The fact is the mainstream media is made up of a lot of individuals who've been trained in journalism, who care a lot about what they write, who want to write the honest truth. So I find fault for just smearing mainstream media as if they're controlled totally by some kind of, you know, blank corporate entity. I mean, there are people who are reporting the truth. Now, sure, definitely I'm not going to say that it's not slanted in a number of different ways. We're seeing that certainly with Israel and so forth. But, you know, what can I say? I mean, the fact is, I'm going to tell honestly, there seem to be fewer jobs in journalism. If you start your own website, if you start your own newspaper, I think you might have a good chance of doing something. It's a very, very difficult, you know, newspapers are failing, magazines are failing. There are many, many, many fewer outlets in print. But, you know, the internet, if you can be a responsible journalist, if you can, you know, break stories, if you can write about things honestly and, you know, not afraid to go, you know, get out there and tell the truth. Yeah, you can do it. There are lots of different ways, too. I know people who started up their own magazines, their own newspapers in towns that need a newspaper. They need some kind of entertainment newspaper. For example, in Sedona, Arizona. Now that's a great example. I mean, because it's not the best example because it's a, you know, it's a tourist metropolis. But if you can find a place that has, you know, a tourist population, you can start your own little newspaper and try to get advertising, see how it grows.
Wow.
Sedona Eccentric was a, you know, a great little paper that it just had, you know, silly news in it, and they were always doing fake news and silly stuff. I even wrote a few things for it because I was covering the New Age movement back then. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can do, you know, do journalism. There truly is. You know, it depends on what you're into. But, you know, it's different from when I was going to school in the 70s. There was no internet. Nothing like that. So, you know, you knew, you know, and you had to go to the library to do research. You didn't do it on your laptop, you know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah. No, I suppose that's changed a lot in recent news, too, with this writer strike and actor strike. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the interesting coverage with the auto workers that seemed to go in a positive direction for labor. But what are your thoughts on like this moment of AI, right? I think there's still value in human creativity and ingenuity.
Oh, of course,
yeah.
Of course there is.
So you're not going to see robots writing stories, or maybe
none. Well, you know, there are already these, you know, software where that will help you write your book and stuff like that. Look, AI is here to stay. You know, it's not going anywhere. You know, I think, you know, the generation behind me is going to be dealing with a lot more than I have to. But, you know, it's here to stay. You're already dealing with it. You're already seeing misuses of it. I've seen speeches by Trump that seem to be somewhat lucid. You know, it couldn't possibly be him. You know, but,
sure.
You know. So, you know, it's here to stay, and we're going to have a lot of fraud. That's what we're going to, you know, that's the worst part. We're going to have a lot of, you know, that is the worst thing that's been, that's come out of the last 5-6 years of politics is the mistrust for the truth. That, you know, there are different versions of the truth, that there are alternative facts. You know, it's just a bunch of bullshit. We know what the truth is. And the fact is that, you know, speak very, very plainly. The way the Republicans have completely ignored the truth, the fact that that Trump can have dinner with a Holocaust denier, you know, these people, you know, and people who are completely anti-Semites, and the Republican Party says nothing. You know, this is not truthful. This is not being truthful. And that is the biggest problem, I think, you know, right here in America right now, and probably around the world, is that people are very, very unsure what's true.
The lack of trust in institutions, but specifically because everyone can open a website, because there's this freedom with the internet to become your own voice. Like, which voice do you trust? And which kind of creates that paranoia of you trust no one almost. But that's interesting, Malcolm. And I came up against this not for a while. It's amazing how things, there's a semblance of normalcy post Trump era. However, we might have another round. We don't know. But this idea of the truth is the truth. I had a debate with a loved one and she was saying, your truth isn't my truth. And I'm like, no, the truth is the truth. There's no your truth or my truth. There's the truth, like gravity, like physics. There's,
I know.
There's some things you can't, have your own version of. And that's what's so wild of how it's shifted so fast.
I think what you said, Chris, about it, I think there's a growing, the people are getting smarter or she said something to that effect, because the fact is, you know, we hear a lot of noise from the right and from the Trump people, and, you know, it gets us off the rails. But the fact is, most of the country can't stand him. And that group of people is growing. He's not going to be elected president. He is going to be convicted. I mean, this is going to happen. And America's going to have to deal with it. You know, this is going to happen. You know, he's a terrible human being. He's done some terrible things to this country. And if you know, maybe you have some Trumpers in your audience, but if you're listening to this guy, you're being conned. It's all there is to it. You know, the things he said the other night when he called people on the left vermin, it's the same kind of words that Mussolini and Hitler used to describe Jews and describe undesirables. You know, that's what he's talking scary. About these days. That's where he's at.
Yeah, there's some alarming parallels, especially with language, the power of language, that superior warp hypothesis of how language can create your reality and how we can get desensitized. That's kind of, we got to know your history, got to know where you're coming from. like Bob Marley said, because there's something to it, because history will repeat itself. And if we don't learn those lessons, it's alarming.
Well, you know, this is one of the sad things about the cannabis movement in itself is, you know, this is what I write about in my book, is the fact that when I started, it was like, man, it was adventure. You know, it was a little bit scary.
Yeah.
Outlaw sensibility.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was fun. It was sexy. You know what I mean? It was just fun to be doing what we were doing, you know?
Yes.
You know, bringing 100 pounds of seeds onto the Navajo reservation.
It's beautiful.
You know, being with the Lakota when they grow.
And it's so cool.
Being with Woody Harrelson, you know, he breaks the law, stuff like that. It was great. And, you know, those days are gone now.
It's unfortunate. Yeah.
Unfortunately, and what's happening is we see these regulators and the bureaucracy, and once again, once the bureaucracy gets involved, we don't know what the truth is. How much THC is in this? Are terpenes important? You know, is THC bad? No, we can't have that much THC. Suddenly the regulators and policy is involved, and people are trying to regulate how much THC can be in a joint in your pot. I mean, what the hell is this?
That's ridiculous. You know? It's ill informed. I mean, really kind of bothers we've spent so much time participating at Board of Supervisor meetings, participating in harm reduction youth. Like talk about how all politics are local just in this community of Santa Cruz.
Sure.
So much work and effort, and it felt like falling on deaf ears. And this is a theme in the past few shows, and things are happening in our community and in the Bay Area and all over the country, where you have to, if you're going to generate tax and regulate as rigorous and overzealous on the cannabis community, you need to at least be informed, or it takes effort to give a darn, and so you need to put in that effort or have stakeholders potentially help with the responsive policy process. I think that's in California, there's just so many pain points and so many sad stories of mom and pop generations losing their land or just forfeiting their license because of the market and the onerous cost of compliance is just pushing a lot of non-corporate operators out of business, and that just furthers the corporate consolidation and the kind of sad thing that happens with capitalism, which is just, you know, you lose all the diversity and all the essence of that sexiness of what got you involved in this space over the 25-year tenure at High Times. So interesting and sad to watch.
Well, all those marijuana growers up in Trinity County and, you know, Humboldt and Mendo and Lake County and Shasta County, all those people, what they did was support their communities. The fact is that money
100%.
That they were generating was going back into their communities. It was supporting schools. It was supporting roads. It was supporting all kinds of businesses.
The Mateel, these nonprofit groups that do everything for the community. Yeah, it was so important. So, Reggae on the River.
I know. And so here, has legalization made things better? Well, people aren't getting busted like they were, but, you know, it certainly disrupted a lot of people's lives and disrupted a lot of different communities. You know, has it been all good? Not by a long shot. And here in New York, I mean, they make these ridiculous forecasts for the amount of revenue they expect to collect.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Cannabis taxes. And you're like, you're way, way off. And the fact the black market is still alive and well. That's where I get my pot. I'm still buying
from
the local dealer, you know, it's a great pot.
Yeah, that's it. There's something to it. Yeah. Well, one positive thing is to enable the people to grow their own, hopefully. Not everyone does
everything.
But that's important.
You know, it's
talking about good quality.
you know, it really is. It's so easy to do, to you know, grow, to have a little greenhouse in your backyard. You know, and I wonder if it were everywhere, if people were just growing it everywhere, people wouldn't want to steal it so much.
You know, that's what I would hope. Yeah. Although there's still, yeah, that's what was so surprising, eye-opening. And, well, there was a smash and grab in South County that had got no coverage. So South County of Santa Cruz is more of the agricultural part of the county, right? So it's more more diverse,
right,
more Latino. So in general, they just don't get the shine. If something happens in the affluent part of the county, everyone is talking about it. It's all over Facebook. It's all over your social media feeds or on the news, KSBW, Channel 8. It's like so much shine, the exact same thing. Probably a worse incident happened. And I had the founders here a month before we played their grand opening, and within a week or two of them operating, they were robbed. So it's just like, geez. Right. And you would think with legalization, I had that in my head that who would risk anything for cannabis, right? Because it's like you said, it's, you can grow it, you can, you just decriminalize to an extent. I mean, in a way, there is a prohibition 2.0 in a post Prop 64 legalization era in California, but it's fascinating, and I've learned.
But you know, it's so funny. You know, when I get my pot, you know, I go to my dealer. It takes about a minute or so. You know, he comes to the door. You know, give him a call. I come. There's no muss, no fuss. I feel safe. Is no problem. You go to a dispensary, you have to wait outside.
Yeah.
You have to look at your license. They have to buzz you in. You know, you have to go to the cash machine or, you know, whatever you have to do. You have to, you know, they pull out the pot. They, you know, you have to look at all, you know, you don't know what you're getting. You don't have a clue. You know, I've been in plenty of dispensaries, but I haven't really bought that much there. You know, mostly when I was covering them and photographing them, and interviewing the people who worked.
Yeah.
I never really, you know, got much pot. But the pot I have gotten out of the dispensaries is really not, you know, for the most part, it's really not been great.
Likewise. I tried it out recently too. I'm the same. I've been blessed to cultivate with friends and family. This is what we do. I was a part of this grand opening, so we got some gift cards. So I was like, great, you know, I want to see what the fuss is about. And I was so disappointed. Even the very expensive, what I thought would be the hype, you know, pretty indoor, it's just little smalls, you know, like a bottom of the bag. And I was like, I can't believe people pay full. Like, luckily I didn't pay full price. I almost didn't pay anything, but I didn't use all the cards I had. I used I paid some money because I was trying to support the business as well.
The best outdoor growers I ever saw were up in Mendo and Trinity and Humboldt. No doubt about it. Those are the best outdoor growers. The best indoor growers. There was a group of guys in Las Vegas who were just out of control, man.
Really interesting.
Very, very best stuff.
Wow, there's Vegas.
This one guy rented a whole house, and you walk into the house, and there were hoses going all over the place, up the stairs. There were different grow rooms, the bathrooms and bedrooms and everywhere. It was just unbelievable. I said, how do you get away with this? He goes, you know, you just kind of look like you're a working man. I got a white van. You know, I keep it in the driveway. You
That's
know, I
right.
wave to the neighbors, keep my curtains down. Always say, I'm coming back from work and stuff like that. And so I always look like I have tools and stuff like that. You know, so, you know, these guys went through this kind of stuff. But I'm telling you, renting a whole house to grow all pot. I said,
a lot of Santa Cruz did that with the housing crisis. A lot of people got desperate. And I was trimming for, a lot of indoor. There was some great indoor cannabis in Santa Cruz. It's so legendary.
One of the best ones I ever saw was in Santa Cruz.
Cool.
This, I swear to God, this guy had was on not stilts. I guess it was raised a little bit above off the ground, and this guy had had drilled a hole through his closet floor, and had sea of green growing underneath the foundation of the house.
Wow!
And it was unbelievable. So he had this, and he had a light that was going back and forth on a line. you know, just
yeah,
constant all the time. But it was unbelievable. There was only about 4 feet of room down there to move around in, but it was an immaculate grow, and it was here. I mean, you would never ever know this, that there was pot growing in this house.
Wow.
I saw a place in Las Vegas where the guy actually in his garage had built a false wall, and it looked like something out of like a Vincent Price horror movie, where the entire wall opens up, and there behind wow. the door is this little grow room. So, listen, the people who were growing little gardens, I was always more impressed with them than anybody else, because they're taking incredible risks in their own house.
Yeah.
And some of the cleverness in what they did in order to grow was just blew me away. I mean, people who had, you know, they had posters on the wall, and it was like, you know, you take the posters off the wall, and there's a, you know, little doorway to get through that you have to crawl through. Just unbelievable.
Willy Wonka, yeah, the ingenuity.
Oh, no,
yeah.
Crazy, crazy stuff. It really was.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Yeah, I haven't totally been there.
People did, you know, and the thing is, they enjoyed doing this kind of stuff. They loved showing it off. Not always, though. I remember back in the 80s when Reagan was cracking down on stuff. You know, listen, getting people in the 80s and early 90s, I should say, when Bush was doing his thing, you know, nobody really wanted to show high times their pot. You know, we had a few, you know, growers who supplied us with stuff for photo shoots and stuff, but it was hard, man. It was hard getting, you know, good stuff to shoot for the magazine. It really was. A lot of growers didn't want us anywhere near them. They were afraid that we'd be followed, you know, and the journalists would be followed. And
yeah.
There are cases where that may have happened a couple times. I know there were a couple of cases that people got busted after we covered them, you know. So,
whoa.
You know,
that's too bad.
So it's,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, back then it was in the 90s, it was Butch Cassidy time, you know, people
yeah,
doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I heard a lot of good things bringing it back to today, in California, the sun grown crops are starting to hit the market, right? Or even in the traditional market, like, you know, we were trimming last weekend. I finally got together with my dad and got a lot of the work cleaned up, and we were blessed. It was a really good banner year as far as quality, which is nice. So it's important to keep the good quality going.
This is outdoor pot?
Yeah, sun grown, full seed, from seed in the soil. Yeah, like beautiful, beautiful work. And what's fun is we're working more in seeds, so just different phenotypes, different expressions. Did some clones, tried to play in the, you know, where people are at, growing some stuff that is commercially known, but also growing stuff that has never been grown out before, new crosses of different cultivars and their expression. And you know, in like Sierra Nevada's Gold Country versus Santa Cruz Mountains, very different. It's beautiful to see how these seeds express their genetic potential. And to do a full term outdoors, really nice.
Yeah, people have to understand how easy it is to grow. I remember one of our most successful articles was just like, you know, a closet grow. You know, you separate your closet, you know, with a divider in the middle of it. You know, and on top are the flowering plants, and below are the vegetation plants. And you just, you know, you just have this, what do you call it, the constant harvest. I can't think of the name of it.
Sure. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Harvesting every 2 weeks, you know, so you always have a supply. You only grow in a couple plants, but it's, you know, keep things clean, and you can have this great cycle going, this endless cycle of pot.
I love it.
If you have the closet, you know, you can do this stuff. People have to, you know, realize it, you know, and believe me, you can get seeds anywhere these days. So all the information on how to grow is online. I mean, you don't need High Times anymore. That's why magazines like that don't really need them. All the information is there. Jorge's got a huge Jorge Cervantes has a huge website.
Great website. Yeah, that's right. It's all out there. But it's community. It's fun to talk shop. Like you said, the people that were open to opening their doors and showing you the gardens. There's a true passion, and there's peace through cultivation. That's something I wish everyone could have, that experience of having a garden and at least trying it out. It's a beautiful thing. I know we're coming into winter, but if you're indoor, it's a year-round thing. You're going all the time, especially for a small garden.
I remember B.E. Smith's garden up in Trinity County, or in the middle of winter. I mean, they just had a huge snowfall, and he took me out to his glass greenhouse that he had space heaters in. It was about 52 degrees there.
Yeah.
But he had beautiful, beautiful plants growing in the middle of winter. So
wow. See, know, there's a will, there's a way. Yeah. Yeah. I've had conversations with organ growers too that'll they'll persevere. They'll keep it going. Yeah. That's especially in the legal space too. You see that it's important to find ways to keep the girls going and there's so much genetic potential. We're still in the very beginnings of understanding.
Oh yes.
It's exciting.
Yep.
There's still hope. There's still things to be happy and celebrate and like pot shots. Oh, yes, this is very exciting. Tommy Chongo did the foreword, right? In the very beginning.
That's right, Tommy.
So cool.
Yeah, like I said, I photographed Tommy 3 times for the cover. I got to know him, became good friends, and he was nice enough to write the foreword to my book. And wrote some very nice things. But the thing is, there's also all of the leaders, from Chris Conrad, Bob Melamed, Raphael Mishulam, all the people that, you've heard about and people have done so much over the years, they're in the book. And all the celebrities who came out for pot, there's a ton of celebrities in the book that I photographed over the years. And, I separated into different chapters. There's a chapter about Woody's Crusade, where he grew hemp. There's the Super Bowl 33 when they actually accidentally legalized pot in Arizona. People don't remember this when they actually did this. I don't know if you still have time. I know it's getting late in the broadcast.
We have time. We have time.
All right. Well, listen. This is 1997. Yeah, this is what happened. In 1994, Arizona thought they added additional penalty for growing pot. If you didn't have tax stamps and a tax stamp for every ounce of pot you had, for every gram you had, you got additional penalties on top of being prosecuted. So one of the head of Arizona Normal, his name was Peter, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, he was busted, and he showed his tax stamps in court. And the judge said, well, the tax itself is penalty. You can't have double jeopardy. So he got to walk. So everybody started buying tax stamps.
Wow. So they can't get, they can't get double jeopardy. Oh my gosh.
Right. So there was actually a cannabis license that allowed you to have it. So everybody was doing this. So at Super Bowl 33, they were selling pot outside the stadium. And this got to be a complete scandal, for the local police and everything. So I went there and covered that. And that was just wild. Now they repealed the law about 3 or 4 months later. But it was really wild because they were selling pot. They had a special brand called Superb Bowl, S-U-P-A-T-R-B.
I love it.
I covered that story in my book, and I cover one of my story where I photographed 100 pounds, and I had to drive the load in order to photograph it. It was 100 pounds of Mexican pot and bales, and that's
wonderful
of high times. So had to do that in order to do it. So you take a big risk. I took a lot of risks when I did some of these shoots, and I almost got caught a few times in South Dakota. I tried to shoot some pot next to Mount Rushmore, and I had the police coming down on me hard, trying to figure out what the hell I was doing. I had to lie my way out of that one.
Whoa.
Because I went up on a ridge that you weren't supposed to be on. They tell you not to park, and I did it anyway. Police came out of everywhere trying to figure out, what are you doing? What are you doing? I'm just photographing this girl up here. It was wild. She had pot up on the ridge, and she came down, and then she came. I said, hey, listen, could you go back up and get your sweatshirt up there? Because that's where the pot was, and she walked right up, got the pot, walked right past the police with the pot, and got in the car. So it was,
woo,
right in front of Mount Rushmore. So, I had, some close calls, But it was all worth it. Once again, Chris, I really appreciate it. Potshot's book is the website. My book is Potshot's Journey of a High Times Photographer. Once again, it's 210 pages, has over 300 shots, and it's a historical art photography book. And people, if you're a stoner, if you want to know about the cannabis history that's got us this far, please buy the book. It's available on ebook and softback. So
yeah, we're excited for that. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We still have the holiday season coming up. So it's a great opportunity. Gift giving.
Chris?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh.
Hello?
Oh, no, you blanked out there a second.
You got me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, so it's perfect time with the holidays. And, you know, it's some piece of history. That's the piece here that there's a whole generation coming out that may not know Jack Herer, may not know.
Yeah,
it's important.
Dennis Perrone
and the roots of this.
Dr. Lester Grinspoon. You know, here he is, a Harvard medical professor, writing books about, you know, marijuana is a harmless drug.
That's right.
Here's a guy who he was a Harvard professor who was doing his own research. He actually started researching marijuana, believing that it was a harmful substance, and came away after doing his research, realizing this stuff is actually very beneficial to people. So, you know, he lent such unassailable credibility to the movement that was his real contribution and the books he wrote.
Yeah, that's a big piece to the story as well. And you mentioned Dr. Raphael Mashulam, who provided the kind of that beginning medical research and cannabis science.
He discovered THC, and he basically discovered how the endocannabinoid system works. And the fact is that cannabis helps the healing process in traumatic brain injury, especially, and in a lot of other cases as well. And Raphael Mashulam, who he died this earlier this year, he's considered the father of marijuana science.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah,
and we're getting to that time too, where there's some of these leaders are passing. So it's important to kind of document.
Sure,
yeah, it's really important to document this movement. And
well, it's been a real pleasure, doing it. I mean, I've been real, really, really blessed and very, very lucky. So,
what a fun trip, man! And there's still more to do, I imagine. Just a different chapter. Things have changed so much. You know, that's the other piece.
Yeah, I know. Cannabis magazines these days, I mean, they basically seem to be covering their advertisers. You don't have that sense of, that we're in this together. We have a mission. We're up against the federal government. You don't have that anymore. That feeling of being like we're doing something here. So it's all about making money now, which I guess it was unavoidable. But
that's
cannabis legalization was all about, I suppose.
Well, there is this moment. Last week, I spoke with an author that wrote about. He's Michael Rising, so he's into mycology, and he's been a part of the movement in Oakland and did the language for the decriminalized nature. That's another like moment in what we're experiencing. I know in California there was a bill to decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms, and I think Scott Wiener was the representative on the state level. Governor Newsom vetoed it, which was interesting. So we're still kind of at status quo. But we have had local governments, like the city of Santa Cruz, decriminalized. They adopted the language of the decriminalized Oakland group and applied it to, and there's cities all over the country now, which is fascinating. What are your thoughts on that? This psychedelic renaissance is kind of like, we don't want to follow the footsteps of cannabis legalization, and I think maybe decriminalization is maybe the first step or a better approach. It's interesting.
It's not really my issue. I certainly don't want people to go to jail for using mushrooms, but I think they have to be used responsibly. These are not innocuous substances. People who have psychological problems may be harmed by the use of them. You know, they certainly shouldn't be in the hands of kids. I think they have to be regulated somewhat. It's a much different issue than marijuana. As I said, you know, we've all done our trips. You know, we all got our pilot's license, and we know what tripping on mushrooms and other psychedelics is all about.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I don't know if it's really, I'm not the one to make the decision.
No, I know.
Right for everyone?
Yeah.
Is it right for everyone? I can't really say that it is, you know, so, you know, it's there has to be some kind of, I don't know. I don't know how you really approach the idea of psychedelics. I mean, they have a great efficacy as far as human evolution is involved. And it certainly does. Something like MDMA has shown to have tremendous benefits to people who are suffering. So, you know, I understand that, and I want people to have access to that. But the idea of tripping and going to the mall and just acting like a dope, you know, that's
Absolutely.
That's kind of where my problem with things.
Yeah. You know, no, but decriminalization, you know, no one should be going, you know, like you said, with your close calls with law enforcement. I think that's the first step.
And
furthering the unraveling of this draconian drug war is really important.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right.
Well, Malcolm, this was a great show. Thank you again.
Oh, listen, it's been my pleasure. Once again, Chris, I mean, you do a great job. And, you know, everybody who's your audience, once again, potshotsbook.com. Check it out, Potshots, Journey of a High Times Photographer. Thank you, everybody. Thank you on the West Coast. Really appreciate
it. Yes, thank you, Malcolm, and thank you, Santa Cruz. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye
now.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.